Oh my god, I get to see your face right in front of me. Ah, I'm so happy.
I know, me too.
I miss this. Now you don't have to edit two audio files.
It feels super awkward though compared to how we've been doing it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I feel fine. I'm excited.
I lied. I have to turn the gain back down. All right. How's it? This should be better. I feel like when we're talking to each other, we talk louder than normal. So.
Yeah, that's true.
This should be good right here. Yes.
We don't have to clap to try to get it lined up. That's how it is on FaceTime. Whenever you ask me to clap, I clap, and then like 2 seconds later, you clap, yep. Even though it's that's even when you're hearing me. Yeah, technically. Well, if it wasn't obvious already, Audrey is with me in New York.
Yes.
How has your stay been so far? Gotta what do you think of?
Oh my god, it's been so fun. I was nervous about the drive because I don't like driving, but I did really well with the drive. I was impressed with myself.
Proud of you.
And what else? I'm trying to think. The drive was easy. I got here. We took lots of naps, which is great. And then we went to Sleepy Hollow, which, oh my god, terrifying. And then also we went to Blood Lake, which is, or Hessian Lake, what you talked about the first episode that you were on. And felt a lot of, a lot of spirits this week, and so emotionally I'm a little bit drained, as I, you know, as that happens. I've never been in such a paranormal heavy place at one time, and so doing that twice in a week, you know, so should I talk about like what
happened? I feel like it'd be great to hear about.
Okay.
It
well, I didn't want to bore anybody.
I don't think it's boring at all. I think no. It's the opposite of boring.
Okay, well, especially for the context of everything. But so basically, what day did we go to Sleepy Hollow? I think we went on Wednesday, yes, because then we went Blood Lake Thursday. So Wednesday, we left here about noonish, I think, got there around 1, 1.30. And the first, we were on the left side of the cemetery, and it's huge. But I was, you know, I was drawn to this one mausoleum, and it was buried in the woods, almost. And so I went over to it, and I felt just, like, weird energy. And there were those, like, flat stone tombs. They weren't the straight-up ones. They were, like, flat on the ground. And they were covered in leaves next to the mausoleum. So the mausoleum had, like, I think the father and the mother, and then their kids were buried outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went over to the flat stones, which is where I kind of got the weird vibe, and I just cleaned off the leaves off of them, and then the energy just kind of cleared, which was really strange. I also haven't been to a cemetery since I started feeling spirits or sensing spirits, so last time I went was Arlington in D.C. in 8th grade, so, yeah. And then there was a mausoleum kind of walkway, and it was just all mausoleum, and I felt weird things pretty much only at the mausoleums. Well, I got this really sharp pain in my stomach at one of them, and I was like, I need to get out of here, and I kind of booked it, and I was doing research on, you know, why I felt weird, and it turns out in that part, I don't want to say park of them, but that strip of mausoleums, there's a cursed statue who apparently will cry blood if you touch it. So that was behind one of the mausoleums, so you couldn't see it from the road that or the walkway. And then we were at Rockefeller's, which we passed by, walked by like two or three times before we found it because we're dumb. But William Rockefeller is buried there, and it's this giant, extravagant mausoleum. There is like, I think it was 20 tombs that are in there, or there's 20 slots for people. I don't really know how it works, but basically, Addie walked up the stairs to the platform, to the entrance of the mausoleum, and she was like, this is really weird. Like, you have to feel what's going on here. I was like, okay. And, I mean, you can talk about what you felt.
Well, for me, it was more of just like, I don't really get scared in cemeteries. It's not something that, like, scares me, you know? Mm. So I'm, like, walking through the whole the whole time that we were there walking through, I didn't feel anything. Like, you started feeling things, and I would just be like, okay. Like, but the only time that I felt something was when I walked up the stairs to the front of it. And the best way I could describe it was just, like, my heart, like, started pounding, like, the closer I got to the window to look inside. And, like, my gut feeling was just, like, you gotta get out of here. Like, you gotta, like, go now. Like, it wasn't any sort of, like pain or anything, kind of, like, what you were feeling. Mm-hmm. It was more of just, like, a gut feeling of just, like, fear. Mm-hmm. And, again, like, I don't feel afraid in cemeteries, so it was just super strange to me all of a sudden, like, get this feeling of, like, fear, and it just felt like the most, like, human response ever, if that makes sense, you know. It just felt like a very, like, instinctual gut feeling kind of a thing, but it wasn't anything, like, I didn't feel any pain, I didn't feel any other, like, body responses, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And so she's like, you have to come up here and feel this because something's off and I'm feeling it. I was like, oh, Jesus, great. Here we go. So I go up the stairs and my entire, and Addie saw this, like, this is, I can't make this shit up. My entire body started vibrating, basically, and just violently shaking. And I turned around and I just stared inside the window and I just got this, it felt like there was, like, a dark cloud just over my head. And Addie was like, get down right now, we're leaving. And so we did some, well, I did some research on it because I was like, there has to be something there. Because Addie said that to her, it felt like there was someone buried there that didn't belong there or someone there that was unwanted. But it didn't feel like human presence was unwanted. It didn't feel like we were unwanted. It felt like someone was angry for a very, very long time. And so I was doing some research and it was very difficult to find who was buried at that specific mausoleum because the Rockefellers have a whole, like a whole plot at Sleepy Hollow. So it was really difficult to find who was at the mausoleum and who was just at the regular plot. So I'm doing my research. After a couple hours, I found that William Rockefeller's great niece, who was buried there, she had committed murder-suicide. So she basically locked her and her children in the garage, turned the car on, and subjected them to carbon monoxide poisoning. I know one of the girls was 6. I think the other one was 12. Don't quote me on that because I didn't exactly write it down or remember it for the sake of telling you guys. But yeah, so that's the unwanted presence that was there. And it was spooky. And then Blood Lake was really interesting. I got, like, the same feeling in my stomach that I got with the cursed statue, but not exactly. It was almost like someone was squeezing my organs. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a sharp pain. Mm-hmm. It was just a lot of pressure inside my abdomen. And it started pretty much as soon as I got out of the car. And then as soon as we left the lake, I felt perfectly fine. But it was really strange. So, yeah, I don't know. New York's, it's great. But there's a lot of scary shit here. A lot of bad shit that happened.
Sorry to subject you to all of that.
It's okay. I didn't take you to Boston because Boston's like that. And yeah. It can get pretty gnarly in Boston, but I guess this is the most in touch I've been with spirits.
Well, this area is also just like jam-packed with history from like the Revolutionary War and even the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just a lot of stuff that happened here.
Right.
So it's normal, I guess, for there to be like unfinished business or whatever, right, have you, just kind of going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, because in New England, all of that shit happened pretty much in Boston, that are cities that are really packed, and so the energy kind of just disperses because, I mean, disperses isn't necessarily the word. I think I just notice it less because I get anxious in big crowds anyway.
Yeah.
So in the city, it's like, I think the feeling of it is all drowned out by the people around me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the vibes of the people around me. I can't really focus on spiritual energy in a busy place like that. But yeah, it was really interesting being somewhere so quiet, but so jam-packed with energy that I had never felt before. It was really interesting. I liked it a lot. It's just, it was a lot.
Good thing that we kind of spent the past couple days just, like, resting, like, napping. Hanging out in my room. Yeah, napping. I've taken a nap every single day. Although yesterday I got to bed early, which was really nice.
You did.
So.
I did too. I fell asleep, and I told Addie I was going to set an alarm, right? So she was like, I'm going to go take a shower. And I was like, okay, I'm going to set an alarm so we can wake up and watch a movie. And then... and then she comes back in, I'm dead asleep, and my alarm goes off at like 11:30 because I took an hour nap. You know, I fell asleep from 10:15-ish to 11:30. My alarm goes off, and I look at her clock on... She has, like, a digital clock on, like, a DVD player or something in here. And it said, 11:29, right? And I look at it, and I'm half asleep. I'm like, oh, perfect timing. I'm supposed to wake up at 11:30.
And I go, babe, you just turned off your alarm. Like, your alarm already did go off.
Yeah.
You so set it for 11:30.
The clock was just behind, like, 30 yeah. seconds.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you can tell the rest of that
well,
story.
Then she, like, kind of opens her eyes, and I was like, you can just go to bed, and, like, you don't have to get up. Like, you can just go back to sleep. You were like, no, I just need to rest my eyes for a little bit. Like, I'll be fine. And then you immediately knocked right back out, and then your alarm went off again because I guess you snoozed it, and you turned it off and then did not wake up until, I guess, this morning because I fell asleep around, like, 1:30. And I, like, was finishing my research, and you just knocked out. You were like, no, thank you.
Things I hate. Myself.
But anyway. It's okay. We rescheduled our movie night for tonight, so we're gonna watch
it with your dad.
Yeah.
Oh, we need to dedicate this episode to him.
Yeah.
Because he's our new Patreon donor.
Yeah, which I'm so appreciative of.
I was going to, but then
I said in my head, I'm not going to do that because he's kind enough to donate to our Patreon, so I don't want to take that chance away from us. But yeah, I'm dedicating this podcast to my dad because he has been listening to our episodes and like joined our Patreon. And so earlier today, he actually asked, he was like, oh, like, when am I going to be able to hear this episode? And I was like, he was like, next Saturday? I was like, oh, probably. And then Audrey reminded me that if you subscribe to our Patreon, which if you like our podcast, you definitely should. We'll get more to that at the end of the episode. But if you subscribe to our Patreon, then you get to hear the episodes once they're edited and finished instead of having to wait for the release date on all the other platforms. So there's that. That's a perk.
Is this better? Oh, that's much better. I can hear my voice better. Technical difficulties. I had to, like, change the settings because it wasn't picking my voice up.
It's fine.
Just waiting.
It's fine. I am doing the episode this week, and I'm very, very excited. I've been waiting all week for you to hear it. Also, I've been, like, doing all of my research and everything. This is the first case that I feel like I actually have enough, not enough information, but a lot of information on, because I was able to find a lot of information for it. So I'm really excited for you to hear it.
And this is your first murder case, right?
Yeah, this is my first murder case. I've done all paranormal ghost before this.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So the title of it is The Trials of Harry Thaw for the Murder of Stanford White.
Which is something that I've surprisingly never heard of.
Yeah. This happened in like 1900s. So.
Okay.
The people
good, so
involved,
nice and far back, yeah. So I don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Is it gonna ruin me?
I don't think so, no. I don't think it'll ruin you. There is, like, I guess trigger warning before I get started. Like, there is mentions of sexual assault and stuff like that, but it's nothing like the Sylvia Likens case. Okay. So it's...
If you could bear through that, you could probably bear through anything else we put out. That and LaLaurie Mansion. Those are, like, the two worst things that you'll ever hear in your life, so...
Not saying that sexual assault is a very light subject at all, but not as intense as those cases is
my main
point. So, the people involved in this case directly are Harry Thaw, Evelyn Nesbitt, and Stanford White. Stanford White was born on November 9th, 1853, to Alexina Black Meese and Richard Grant White.
That's a pretty name.
Isn't that? I love
Alexina?
It. Yeah.
I like that.
His father was a Shakespearean scholar, and although they didn't have a lot of money, he had many connections to the art world. Stanford White did not have any formal architectural training, but when he was 18, he was an apprentice to Henry Hoboson Richardson, who was kind of like a prominent architect at the time.
Yeah, I wasn't laughing. I was just the name.
Hoboson?
Yeah.
In 1878, his father sent him on a trip to Europe to study architecture. Okay. When he returned from the trip, he met two young architects named Charles Fallon McKim and William Rutherford Meade. They created a firm called McKim, Meade, and White, which makes sense.
Yep.
So all of the designs that they created could be accredited to the firm and not just to one individual.
Okay.
So that way they could kind of, like, not have to fight over rights of designs, I guess.
Okay.
In 1884, he married a woman named Bessie Springs Smith, and they had a son in 1887 named Lawrence Grant White. Some of White's most famous work include the Triumphal Arch in Washington Square Park.
Oh, wow.
The second Madison Square Garden, which was destroyed in 1925, but it was originally created in 1890.
Okay.
The first Bowery Savings Bank,
mm-hmm.
Judson Memorial Church, and the Gold Memorial Library at NYU. That's just to name a few. Yeah. Yeah. So he was pretty well known. Like, okay. He's made a lot of famous architectural things, buildings in New York City. White was described as masterful, intense, and burly, yet boyish. He liked to collect artwork. He had a room in his studio at Madison Square Garden, which was green with a red velvet swing in the middle. This note is important later, but he used the swing to groom young girls.
Oh, yeah. That's less funny.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes up again.
Oh, me. I would get a room just to put a swing in there. Yeah. And then, yeah. No. Now I'm upset. Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
He's gross.
Yep, no, horrible.
A family historian named Susanna Lezard said, the process of seduction was a major feature of Stanford's obsession with sex, and it was an exonerable kind of seduction, which moved into the lives of very young women, sometimes barely prepubescent girls.
Stop.
In fragile social and financial situations. Girls who would be unlikely to resist his power and his money and his considerable charm. Who would feel that they had little choice but to let them take over their lives. There are indications that Stanford would sometimes adopt the role of a paternal benefactor and then would take advantage of the trust and gratitude that had been built.
Thanks, I hate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Not a great guy so far.
No, clearly not. I hate him. Am I supposed to hate him?
Yeah.
Thank God.
I feel like...
It's hard not to.
It's hard not to, and as I continue later on, like, there's no, like, good people in this case, really. Great. Like, except for Evelyn, which I'll get into a little bit. She is really not to blame for anything, but everyone involved is just kind of like a dick.
Great.
So
great.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I'll get over it.
This is a little bit unrelated, but Mark Twain also knew this guy. Oh, and cool. Like, said some stuff about him as well. Just like,
listen, if Mark Twain is saying shit about you, you know you fucked up.
Yeah. So that's the background on Stanford White. This is where you're also going to hate this guy.
Am I just going to want to, like, throw your laptop at the wall?
I hope not, because I just got this laptop.
No, I would never. I'm just going to act violently and maybe yell.
That's fine.
Okay.
I will allow that.
I'm already stressed.
It gets worse.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. She rubbed my shoulder and then just looked me dead in the eye and said, it gets worse. That's helpful. Thanks. Thanks.
So, Harry Thaw was born Harry Kennedy Thaw on February 12, 1871, and was the son of William Thaw Sr. and Mary Sibbett Copley. His father was a coal and railroad baron, and Thaw ended up inheriting a lot of money, like multiple millions of dollars kind of money.
Back in the 1900s?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, a lot.
Billions.
Yeah.
In today. Okay.
A lot of money. He had five siblings, one of which was accidentally smothered by his mother when he was an infant.
Jesus Christ. How do you accidentally smother your child?
He was laying on the bed with her, and she, like, rolled over. Yeah. But also...
Still, why?
His mother also apparently abused servants and was known for having a bad temper.
Oh, cool. So, maybe not an accident that her child...
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Thaw suffered with mental illness all his life. When he was a child, he would have temper tantrums and regularly talk like a baby, a habit that remained into his adult life.
Ew.
Yeah. Creep. He would throw heavy household items at the servants' heads as a form of amusement. He liked seeing people get hurt.
It's very, like, Dandy from American Horror Story.
Yeah, yeah. He bounced around schools a lot, and his teachers described him as an unintelligent and troublesome young fella.
I mean, as they should.
Yeah. The only reason that he went to college was because he used his father's name and status to weasel his way into the University of Pittsburgh and then eventually Harvard.
Great. Great.
Yeah. It didn't take long for him to be expelled from Harvard for his extremely inappropriate behavior. He would go on drinking binges, attended cockfights, did lots of drugs, specifically cocaine. That was like his drug of choice. And he would seduce women. The event that actually got him expelled occurred in 1894 when he chased a cab driver down in Cambridge and pointed a shotgun at the driver who he believed swindled him out of 10 cents.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And then he was given 3 hours to move out. So his expulsion was immediate. They said, 3 hours, get out of here.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Also, 10 cents, which is, like, a little bit more, like, back in the day. Like, I think it's, like, a few dollars.
I will calculate it. What year is this?
1900.
Okay.
Or 1893, but same thing. La la la, la 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 la.
La, 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 la. It's $3.07.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like, that's less than I tip for a cup of coffee.
Yeah. So, he expelled from Harvard.
Great.
Before his death, William Thaw, his father, reduced his monthly allowance to $2,500 in an effort to stop his son's erratic behavior. Jesus. This is still an insane amount of money for the time.
I don't even have $2,000
right.
in bank account.
Right. When he passed in 1893, Harry inherited about $3 million and his mother increased his monthly allowance to $8,000.
Jesus Christ.
The total estimated amount of money inherited was around $40 million.
Are you shitting me? And that was just at the time. That wasn't...
Yeah, yeah, that's just at the time.
Oh, my God.
From this point forward, his mother and a slew of lawyers acted as a kind of damage control to protect their reputation. They would regularly pay people to keep their mouths shut. An example of this was when Harry lured an unsuspecting bellboy into his hotel room where he tied him up and laid him in the bathtub before torturing him with a whip.
Are you shitting me?
Not shitting you.
Was it the spine whip? I'm sorry.
Callback. I'll do another episode.
No, I'm trying to cope. I can't.
I know.
I'm sorry.
And this was just one incident. There's another one that they talk about later on.
I don't want to hear it, though. I really don't. I'm kidding. I do. I really want to hear it.
He was a manipulative sociopath who was able to keep his dark persona hidden and could easily convince people that he was a warm and caring individual. Okay, so now we're getting into Evelyn.
Okay.
Who, I will show you pictures of her. Oh my god, so beautiful.
Wait, did you say yet how these three knew each other, or are these...
Not yet.
You're just explaining how they're each involved.
Yeah, I'm explaining their background,
right.
Who they are.
Okay,
yeah.
okay.
Sorry. So, Evelyn Nisbet was born on Christmas of 1984 or 1985.
Her 1884 or 19?
I'm sorry, 1884.
Okay, okay.
I don't know why I put 19, sorry. I messed up. I was very tired when I was typing this up.
Okay. I forgive you.
Her records were destroyed in a fire, so her birth year is unknown. And also, okay. Her mom would change the year of her birth to abide by child labor laws. So, we don't really know when she was born, but she...
The opposite of Dee Dee Blanchard. Do you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will cover that eventually.
I love that case.
I do too.
So good.
I mean, I hate it.
Yeah.
It's very fascinating.
Yeah. She was born to Winifield Scott Nesbitt and Evelyn Florence. Her father was an attorney and her mother was a homemaker. She had a very close relationship with her father and he supported all of her interests. She loved reading, so he made her a library in the house and filled it with books, even those that were mainly of interest to boys at the time. She was also interested in music and dance, so he got her lessons.
Oh,
so nice.
Also. Very sweet.
The family moved to Pittsburgh in 1893, shortly after, when Nisbet was 10. Her father passed away suddenly and left the family poor.
Oh.
They lost their house and had to sell all of their belongings in order to pay off the debt. Her mother was unable to find work, and the family ended up living in boarding houses. Her mother would send her brother to live with family members and eventually would come into money and tried to run a boarding house, but it didn't last long.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Nesbitt then moved to Philadelphia in order to find a job while her children stayed with a family friend. She got a job as a clerk at a Wanamaker's department store and eventually got her children jobs at the store as well, so okay. they could all make money.
And this was Evelyn's mother?
Yes.
Okay.
An artist saw Evelyn at the store one day and asked if she would pose for a portrait. Her mother approved after finding out the photographer was a woman, and Evelyn made the equivalent of $27 in today's money with just one session. After realizing that modeling would bring in more money than working at the store, she begged her mother to allow her to continue this career. Her mother then became her manager and got her in contact with artists in New York City.
This is always how it starts.
Mm-hmm. She claims she never allowed her underage daughter to pose nude for anything, but some of Evelyn's work shows otherwise. She quickly became one of the most in-demand artists in New York. She posed for magazines such as Vanity Fair, Harper's Bazaar, The Delineator, Ladies' Home Journal, and Cosmopolitan.
Wow.
She also posed for an array of advertisements and calendars. Her modeling career brought in more money than the whole family combined working at the department store.
Oh, shit.
But most of her earnings were used to afford the apartment they had in New York.
Oh, because that makes sense.
Rent is very expensive. Yeah.
Right, and their father died, so.
Yeah. Evelyn eventually got bored with modeling and got a job as a choir girl, which is how she met Stanford Voigt. This is where things start to go downhill.
Great.
Yeah. So I'm going to get into a little bit of Voigt and Nesbitt's relationship. Stanford Voigt, after creating the firm McKim, Mead & Voigt, created the design for Madison Square Garden.
Okay.
At MSG, he had a top floor filled with suites where he would host parties with spicy entertainment.
Jesus Christ.
At these parties, most of the time, he would invite underage girls to attend. They would wear very provocative clothing and be forced to entertain the guests.
I don't like that you're serious.
Why?
Because it's uncomfortable.
I'm just trying to, because there's like,
get through it.
Yeah, there's just a lot and it just like is never good. No. So as like a fear reaction, I'm just like, ah.
Why does this remind me of Gatsby though?
It really does. It really does.
Like she reminds me of Daisy.
Yes. Yeah.
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 Okay. Glad we're on the same page.
Evelyn was invited out to dinner by a friend, but didn't know where they were going. Her friend invited her to Voigt's studio. It was at this luncheon that Voigt showed the girls his green room with the velvet swing.
No, thank you.
Voigt was able to win the favor of Nesbitt's mother by acting as a paternal figure.
Stop.
And giving them financial assistance.
How old was he?
She was like, I want to say maybe like 14, 15.
And he was a grown-ass adult?
Yeah. He was like, I want to say in his 20s. I could be wrong, though. I could be wrong.
Still gross.
But she was young. Like, she was underage, and he was older than her.
Right.
Significantly older than her. So, her mother greatly appreciated the money that he gave them because it allowed her to live a lavish lifestyle. About a month later, Voigt invited her to the studio again after a performance she had at Madison Square Garden because she was a choir girl mm-hmm. at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed that three other girls would be at the party, but upon arriving, she was told that the other girls had disappointed him. He offered her a glass of champagne, and shortly after drinking it, she fell unconscious.
Oh my god.
When she woke up, she was in one of the suite rooms, which was covered in mirrors.
Stop.
She noticed that there is blood running down her thigh, and then she realized she was sexually assaulted and completely lost it. Voigt said to her, "Don't cry, kittens. It's all over. Now you belong to me," and made her promise that she wouldn't tell her mother. I'm just gonna give you a minute.
Yeah, because I'm crying. I hate you.
I'm sorry.
I don't know how I've never heard of this one.
Yeah, I'm surprised too, because this was called, like, the trial of the century, like, when this happened. Sorry, I just cracked my knuckles right into the camera. I mean...
The camera, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was literally called, like, trial of the century. Like, it got... This was, like, one of the first cases... In the United States, I'm pretty sure to get, like, a lot of, like, publicity. Not publicity, but,
Media coverage.
Media coverage.
I'm gonna take a wild guess here. She told someone and then no one gave a shit.
No.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. Well, because remember that he's, like, paying for a lot of, like,
yeah, shit for her. Yeah, I forgot about that.
So, and her mother approved of this.
I don't like it.
Yeah.
It's the velvet swing that just, like, I'm just thinking of a giant, giant room with, like, Victorian wallpaper, like, green wallpaper, and then, like a bench seat, like a bench velvet seat hung from the ceiling in chains.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm picturing. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, creaking back and forth, mm-hmm. and it's just giving me the heebs.
Yeah.
And, oh, that poor baby. Okay.
She went through a lot.
You can keep going. I will. I'm gonna need a second, actually. I actually really hate this.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Keep going.
Okay. This unhealthy sexual relationship continued for about 6 months.
Oh my god.
In the summer of 1902, the actor, who wasn't an actor at the time, but would then be, like, a very famous actor, John Barrymore and Evelyn met at one of Stanford White's lavish parties. While White was away on a fishing trip in Canada, Barrymore swept in and wooed Evelyn. Their relationship was not a secret, and soon Mrs. Nesbitt found out. Prior to this happening, Mrs. Nesbitt made Evelyn promise that she would not be in a relationship with any other man other than Stanford.
Oh my god.
Yeah. She then asked White to break up their relationship. He suggested that they send her off to a boarding school in New Jersey. So her mother then sent her to a school.
I hate her mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she allowed this to happen.
Right. There's a lot of very,
and it, like, wasn't, like, it wasn't a secret what Stanford was doing. Like, no. A lot of people knew about it. And there's something, like, later on that comes up.
Right.
But, like, everyone knew that it was a thing. And no one did anything about it.
Well, the thing is, and I'm not excusing it by any means, but the thing is, too, is that sexual assault didn't become a felony or a crime of any sort until, like, the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. Before then, it was just like, well, like, what were you wearing?
Right.
Like, you were asking for it. No matter what, it was always you were asking. So no one gave a shit.
Yeah.
And that's not helping her case.
Right. Right. So now I'm going to get a little bit into Thaw and Nesbitt's relationship.
Great.
Thaw first met Evelyn after attending many of her shows at Madison Square Garden.
Wait, Thaw's the guy whose dad was, like, fucking Loden was giving him,
yes,
allowances.
Yeah, he's of, like, one.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thaw, yep.
Talks like a baby.
Yes.
Okay, okay, okay.
Yeah. He went to over 40 performances and would constantly send her flowers and gifts. He asked her out multiple times and she always politely declined. Thaw hated White because he knew what he did to young girls, and this hatred only drew Thaw closer to Nesbitt. He wanted to protect her, I guess. He finally got a date with her and made a ridiculous show of affection by dropping to his knees and exclaiming that she was the prettiest girl in New York.
Okay, that's dramatic.
Yeah.
That's a bit much.
Yeah. While Nesbitt was at the boarding school in New Jersey, she had appendicitis. And so Jesus. Both Thaw and White would come to visit her. And there was a lot of gossip at the school about her relationship with the men. When she was in surgery, Thaw and her mother discussed her future. And a few months after, they went on three of them went on a long vacation in Europe. During the vacation, Evelyn and her mother got into an argument, and her mother ended up leaving and going back to the States, leaving Thaw and Evelyn alone in Europe.
Who are the two men again? I'm sorry.
So, Stanford White is the architect, the one who designed White Madison.
White is the creepazoid.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
And Thaw and, is okay. The other creepazoid.
That talks like a baby.
That talks like a baby.
Okay, yeah. Okay, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have a hard time following sometimes.
No, that's okay.
Continue.
She told him about what Stanford had done, and Thaw reacted as if he was appalled. Like, he was like, oh my god, you poor thing. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that he did that to you. Because he already hated White. So this was just even more, like, this is just adding fuel to the fire.
Okay.
This next part, you're going to hate it.
Great, 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 great. I already hate it. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Mm.
One night, while staying in a castle in Austria, Evelyn woke up to Harry standing over her, and then he began slashing her with his riding whip. He tore off all of her clothes and sexually assaulted her.
Harry Thaw?
Yes.
Oh my god.
All while screaming how much he hated Stanford White for doing exactly that.
Addie!
I'm telling you, they're both shit.
Yes, they are. They're both horrible.
They're both terrible.
Jesus Christ.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I'll get over it. I'm just upset.
I know.
Evelyn survives, right?
Yes. Thank God. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I titled this next section Complicated Relationships. Uh-oh.
I hate you. You're adding just your little sprinkle of humor.
Yeah.
Just to...
I'm trying to, at least.
It's hard. It's hard.
I know.
Yeah, that's gonna be the title. Complicated Relationships. Uh-oh.
Evelyn Nesbit returned from her vacation with Thaw in October of 1903. Thaw returned later that November. After she returned, Stanford White made an appointment for them to meet with a lawyer named Abe Hummel.
For why?
Well, I'll get into that. It's literally the next line.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. At this appointment, an affidavit was written up that stated that Thaw beat Evelyn until she was unconscious multiple times and that he was a cocaine fiend. The affidavit also stated that this occurred because Evelyn wouldn't sign a different affidavit stating that White drugged and abused her.
Oh my god.
So he's writing
fighting over her like she's fucking property.
Yeah.
They're both horrible.
Yeah. In the affidavit that White drew up, he made sure it stated that all the accusations against him were false. And Evelyn signed this affidavit, but afterwards claimed she did not know what it said. A.S. Snide-Decker, I wrote some guy, I guess, I don't know, because his name was literally never mentioned before this. He swore that she read the paper carefully before signing it.
Do you think he was the lawyer?
Possibly. Well, no, the lawyer was Abe Hummel.
Oh, yeah, then I don't
know. So, or a witness, maybe? A witness probably later on in a case or something.
And I feel like everyone's in this just to fuck her over, though.
Yeah. Yeah. There are, like, she seems to, like, be on the side of Thaw. She seems to...
Well, because he's acting like her knight in shining armor.
Right. But she also, like, there are several, I didn't get into detail of them because there was just so much, like, in the trials and stuff that I just didn't feel like adding. But, like, there are a couple times where, like, people accused her of lying and, like, all of this stuff. Like, kind of just, like, flipping the script against Stanford to try to make sure Harry...
Isn't she still a minor at this point?
Yes, maybe.
I mean, she can't be older than 20.
No, absolutely not, no.
So...
Well, because... She was born in 1885, and Thaw was born in 1871, and Stanford was born in 1853. So Stanford is the oldest, 20 years older than Thaw, and Thaw is
14 years older than her.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Stanford's 34 years older, if I'm doing my math correctly, if he's 20 years older than Thaw... And then Thaw is 14 years older than Evelyn.
Yeah.
That makes Stanford White is 34 years older than Evelyn.
Sure.
Are you pulling out your calculator to make sure my math is correct?
Well, no, I was going to try to see, like, how old she was, because this happened in 1902. 17, yeah.
So she's still a minor.
She's still a minor.
Great, 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 great. Yeah. All around great.
Yep.
Not really. I'm kidding. Please don't quote me on that. That was not serious. It's not great. It's actually terrible.
Yeah.
Please, no one take me seriously right now.
We're just coping. We're just trying to cope.
Yeah, coping, it's not something that happens. It's just an attempt we make.
Mm-hmm. So Thaw returned in November from Europe, and she told him about what happened in the law office, and he asked that the affidavit then be burned in her presence, but the lawyer took a picture of the document before burning it.
Jesus Christ.
After this incident, Evelyn spent most of her time focused on Thaw and stopped associating with Stanford White. Ben Bowman, an employee at MSG, stated that he would kill Thaw at once after pulling out a revolver because when he asked if Evelyn was still around after a performance, he was notified that she had gone home. That was White. Sorry. The way I worded that was kind of weird, but like White was like, I'm gonna kill Thaw. Like he tried to find her after a performance she had
but she was with Thaw.
Yeah. And so he was like, I'm gonna kill him. Whatever.
So dramatic.
I know. Bowman then relayed this information to Harry Thaw soon after. I know. Thaw was able to win over the favor of her mother by giving her lavish gifts and spending time with her. Harry and Evelyn then got married on April 4th, 1905. They got married.
So she's 20 years old, which makes him 34.
Yeah.
Great.
A few months after getting married, Thaw met Anthony Comstock and reported that White was using his studio above MSG to trap young girls. An investigation then took place, but no evidence was found. White would then annoy Evelyn and claim that he would get her back from Thaw. And then she would relay this information also to her husband.
Okay.
So everything that White is trying to do to, like, get her back.
Or, this is backfiring on
right, because she's telling Harry, and he already hates the guy, so.
Right.
I don't know if you know where this is going, but.
Someone's gonna die.
Someone's dying, yeah. They both literally want to kill each other, so yeah. It could go either way.
Yeah.
All right, so this is the actual murder that took place.
Great.
So Evelyn and Harry had planned a vacation for the spring of 1906 with plans to leave on June 28th. On June 25th, Evelyn left her hotel to meet Harry at the bar where he had already started drinking.
Oh, great.
And apparently he had like a $3 tab and he paid with a $100 bill just to be an ass. They then went to dinner at Cafe Martin where Evelyn saw Stanford White walk in with his son. She immediately felt afraid because
This guy had children?
Yeah, he had a son with his wife.
Oh my god, I forgot he was married.
Yeah.
And he's chasing this.
Yeah. One. Yeah.
Okay. Keep going. I'm sorry.
If I remember correctly, like his wife and their son, like his son went to Harvard and his wife lived in Massachusetts.
Great.
All the time while he's in New York doing this shit.
Great.
Yeah. She immediately felt afraid because she wasn't sure how her husband would react if he saw him there. She passed him a note that said, "The bee was here but has left," and to her surprise, Thaw remained calm. Mm-hmm. After dinner, the couple went to MSG to watch the new musical Mamselle. During the show, Thaw realized that White was also in attendance as he took a seat at the table facing their party. Great. Witnesses report seeing Harry pacing at the back of the theater during the show. Evelyn suggested that they leave and make their way towards the elevator. She believed that Harry was right behind her, but he had stopped following her and made his way to White's table. When he reached the table, he drew out his revolver and shot 3 times at Stanford White.
Jesus Christ.
In the middle of a show.
Very John Wilkes Booth of him.
Yeah. The first shot was made from a bit of a distance and went right through Stanford's eye into his brain, killing him instantly. The other 2 shots were made at close range, one in his head and one in his shoulder. Evelyn immediately knew what her husband had done and exclaimed that he shot him. And then Harry exclaimed, "I did it because he ruined my wife. He had it coming to her. He took advantage of the girl and then deserted her." And he was immediately dragged out by police officers.
Good.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
And then he tells Evelyn, "Oh, I probably saved your life."
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Had 3 people throughout her entire life just trying to save her life. But she's a capable adult.
Right. Like,
leave her alone.
Right. Well, it's because she's a child during the, like, beginning part of this, you know what I mean? Like, of she course, was a child, but... and so, like, these people just knew that they could take advantage of her. Like, her right. mom wanted her money, and she kept meeting these men who were willing to pay off whatever they needed and shower them in money and gifts and whatever. Right. So she, of course, she's going to take advantage of that.
Right.
You know? And, right. like...
She didn't need protecting from any of these yep. people. She yeah. needed protecting... Like, not... They didn't need her to protect them. She needed protecting from them.
Yes.
You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I'm just... Okay. I'm done. Keep going.
At 3 a.m., he was charged with murder, and he was moved from the station house to Tombs Prison.
Okay.
And then this is kind of, like, with the trials and stuff. It's not too much detail, but, like, things that were kind of important.
Mm-hmm.
The defense's argument was that Harry Thaw was insane when the murder had occurred, but came to his senses after the fact. A test to see if Harry was insane was done, and it was concluded that at the time of the exam, he was sane. The case was submitted to the jury, and after 47 hours, 47 Jesus hours, Christ. The jury was sitting and, like, toiling over this, they could not come to a conclusion.
Are you kidding me? There were so many witnesses. You said it was
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was in Madison Square Garden during a performance. Anyway.
I hate it here.
In a second trial, evidence was presented to try to show that Thaw was insane. On February 1st, 1908, he was found to be not guilty because he was insane at the time that White was killed.
I am
apparently
about to smash my head against the wall.
Yeah. He was transferred to a mental institution, but tried to be released a year later. A judge heard his case, but several people testified that he was a degenerate paranoiac and would never recover. Mrs. Susan Merrill testified that between 1902 and 1905, Thaw pretended to be a theatrical agent and would lure women into his hotel room, where he would then whip them. She also testified that his family would pay these women hush money, stating that one person was paid $7,000. Oh, that's separate from the other case before.
Yeah.
Then the whip was brought in as evidence.
Oh my god.
He was re-returned to the asylum, and the judge declared that he would be a danger to the public if he was released.
I mean, he is a danger to the public, but...
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody here is. Everybody in this case is, except for Evelyn.
I know.
This poor baby.
In 1915, he tried again for a third time to get out of the asylum, and this time he was found to be sane and he was released.
No.
By this point, Evelyn had lost all of her feelings for him, and they divorced shortly after his release.
Good.
In 1917, Harry severely whipped... I'm sorry, it's not funny. It's not funny. It's just, like, this guy, like, can't quit. Like, he does not stop being a dick. In 1917, Harry severely whipped a 19-year-old boy and was arrested and returned to the mental asylum.
Good.
He stayed there...
Not good that he hurt the child, but good that he got returned.
Yeah. He stayed there until 1924, and then he died in 1947.
What? So he was just out and about for 23 years? I guess so. Honestly, I thought it was going to be White that murdered
Thaw.
Thaw.
It could have gone either way. I think it could have gone either way.
I think it was like, who's going to beat the other person to it first.
Right, exactly. Yeah. After her divorce to Harry, she married her dance partner Jack Clifford, but the marriage would be short-lived.
Aww.
She never remarried, and then she died in 1967 due to natural causes. So still, like, you know.
She lived a good life, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she didn't, I don't want to say didn't get into more trouble, but, like, didn't, I guess it seems like it didn't, doesn't seem like she got in any shitty relationship
with
more shitty men. And, yeah. Like, she was able to look out for herself.
Right. That's the kind of vibe that I got. I don't think that her marriage to Jack Clifford, and again, I didn't go into research about what that marriage was like at all, so I really don't know, but, like, the vibe that I get off is, like, they just, like, didn't work out or something, and she just didn't want to be in a relationship. Like, especially after all this shit that happened, she probably had some young,
very deep-rooted trauma.
Yeah. Like, I don't blame her for not wanting to get married.
No. Not and at all.
There's actually a movie about this. It's called...
You have to watch it.
Yeah, The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing.
That's horrible.
Yeah. But in that movie, she was living quietly as a 74-year-old sculptor in Los Angeles.
Oh.
So... Oh, wait. That was... Oh, the movie was made in 1955. So when the movie came out, she was a sculptor. In Los Angeles.
Oh,
no! Wow. I thought, when I first read that, I thought that's what the movie had depicted, but she was still alive when it came out.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah.
Good for her being a sculptor in LA. Wow. Holy shit. That gave me whiplash.
Right? It's a lot. I didn't think that it was gonna be, like, that bad, but it gave me a lot of anxiety. Yeah.
I liked it. I mean, obviously, it was shitty and horrible. I didn't like it, per se. It kept me on my toes, you know? Because
You never really know what's gonna happen.
No. No.
But poor Evelyn. I really feel for her. Like, she was just a victim throughout this whole thing. Like, she never really gained anything from it, but at least, like, they both died, you know? like, she outlived both of them. Yeah, and, like,
it was a big fuck you.
Right, yeah.
Oh my god. Wow. That was good. That was a good case. Yeah, I can't believe I've never heard of that one. That one's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised too. Maybe it just, I don't know, it's so old that it's like, there have been so many, like, serial killer murder cases since this happened. Yeah, so it's like.
That's true. Because, like, I don't know, I feel like I don't hear a lot of old-timey murders on the podcast that I listen to or any of my research, so. How'd you find this? Did you just...
I just Googled crimes that happened in New York. Like, I just, like, Googled that, and I came to this website, which has, like...
Oh!
It has a whole, like, an archive of famous cases that happened in...
Is this her?
Yeah, that's her.
Oh, wow, so she was beautiful.
Let me show you...
Oh, girl, you can do better.
Both of them. Well, let me show you, like...
What is that mustache? It's like a squirrel.
So ugly, ugly. This has, like, pictures of her. Beautiful.
Oh, wow.
She's gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Wow.
We can skip past that one. That one's a painting. But, like, this one? Are you kidding me?
Holy crap. I mean, I'd be in love with her, too, but I wouldn't kill for her or, you know, violently assault her.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. Sorry it was a lot.
No. Because we did really well on time, too. Look, you reached almost a full hour. Oh, my God.
Finally, a case where I didn't spend just, like, half an hour with minimal information, and then it's just us rambling.
Well, and I'm impressed, too, because old-timey cases like that are hard to find information on. Mm-hmm. So.
I had, like, so this was the one thing, like, this had all of the details about it. So, like, I guess it was just really well recorded for the time because it was one of those things that, like, everybody wanted to know, like, what happened. Because it was big people for the time, you know? Like, they were all, like, famous, wealthy people living in New York who wouldn't want to be involved, who wouldn't want to know what's going on with these people, you know?
Mm-hmm. As shitty as it sounds, it's like my brain can only think of, like, Evelyn as the only victim in this, you know what I mean?
Oh, 100%.
And, like, I think that it sucks that someone got murdered, but at the same time, it's like, I'm just glad Evelyn's alive.
Yeah.
And that's really the only thing my brain is thinking right now is I'm glad that she was able to survive and kind of conquer the rest of her life like a badass, you know? So.
Yeah. I'm sure that other people were also kind of glad that Stanford was dead.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I'm glad he's dead. I'm just saying I'm glad that.
Yeah. I mean, like, people at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's one of those deaths that's kind of controversial because it's like, ooh, like, he was a very famous architect, but also you suck, so it's, like, hard to.
Yeah. But I just see her as the biggest victim in all of this, I guess is my point. But she's the one that survived. You know what I mean? So it's just really changed my perspective. What is happening upstairs? Menacing things.
Dad?
I have to go to the bathroom.
I need to, like, lay down for a good 10 minutes.
Yeah, you need to recover decompress from this. Well, do you want to do the spiel or do you want me to do it?
Oh, I did it last time, so you can do it.
Okay. That being said, you can find us on Instagram at yourworstnightmaretcp. You can find us on Twitter at nightmaretcp. You can send us a Gmail with your listener stories, which we really, 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 really want to do. So please, please send those in. Any, like, encounters with ghosts, pretty much any stories that you have, like the one I told in the beginning, that's even something short and sweet like that. Just send it in. Or an encounter with a murderer or something. I don't know. And that was the Gmail, right? I said. And then Patreon is, you can donate $5 a month. You get early access to episodes. You get our notes that we take for the episodes. We're hoping soon to have enough designs and stupid little photoshopped art that I keep making. And so I'm trying to have it set up so that every 3 months each patron gets a sticker. And so I can do that through Patreon. So hopefully we'll have that up and running really soon. And we should have merch coming once I get those designs more squared away and stuff. So yes, I think that's everything. Patreon.com/yourworstnightmaretcp. I don't think I actually said the link, but yeah. So, I love you guys. I really have to pee, so I'm signing off.
Bye. Love you. Bye.
Bye.